cold open. Oh my gosh, it's happening. Hello, everyone. It's kind of not happening, but it also is, but kind of not. But you'll see. So here's the situation. I am currently on a show, a show that is on the internet called Dimension 20. The season is called Mentopolis. It's a lot of fun. It's a tabletop role-playing game show. And this season is me and a bunch of cool people being inside of a man's mind and trying to solve mysteries. It's like a, it's like Inside Out, but noir detective thriller. And it's very fun. And you can watch the first episode for free on YouTube. And then the rest of them are behind a paywall at dropout.tv, which is a subscription service that I quite like. And I'm a big Dimension 20 fan. And I was really excited to be on the show. And I am. And when I was like, okay, well, this show is going to come out, what we should do is we should record a bunch of podcasts with all the other people who are on the show with me. And then I got diagnosed with cancer and I got very busy with that. And I had only recorded one of them. And so, and I was, we were going to release them during the release of Mentopolis, which is now going on. So we're going to release the one that I recorded, which is with Mike Trapp. And you can get that. And it was recorded back before I had a diagnosis of any, I did not know there was anything wrong with me. And you can watch the first episode of Mentopolis on YouTube by searching Mentopolis on YouTube. So this is kind of not the thing. It's kind of, we're kind of not coming back, but the news is we also are coming back. We're going to start recording Dear Hank and John again, and they will start coming out in October. I believe that's the plan. They might come out a little bit sooner than that, but we'll see. We're still, you know, in sort of a transitional phase. Somebody used the phrase healing season. You're in a healing season with me the other day. And I'm like, yes, I am in a healing season. And I'm going to try and take care of me as much as I can. So thank you. We're sorry that we went away for so long. And then we are very excited to come back. But in the meantime, I hope that you will enjoy this episode of Dear Hank and John, except it is not Dear Hank and John. It's Dear Hank and Trap. Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I like to call it, Dear Trap and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers and sometimes a brother and a friend to answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon, but probably not that this week. Hello! We're joined by a special guest today. This is Mike Trapp of Actually and various other cool things that have happened in the world. College Humor stuff and sometimes Dungeons and Dragons things. Hello!
Hello! Thanks for having me.
Do you know why you're on Dear Hank and John?
I think it has something to do with the fact that we have recorded and hopefully by the time this comes out, put out a season of Dimension 20 called Mentopolis. And we had a great time playing.
We did.
I was going to say D&D together. I guess it was Kids on Bikes, but we tabletop together. We had a great time. And now we're keeping the party going.
It's been so hard to not talk about this. I don't know how people do that. I am a YouTube boy and I live a YouTube life, and to have made a piece of content, I don't even know, like months, almost a half a year between when it was recorded and when it comes out is very uncomfortable for me, especially when I have been as excited about it as I am about this.
Yeah, you don't get that instant gratification. I've been writing for animated shows since 2020. And
what are some of your credits?
Well, that's what I was just about to say. I can't talk about any of my credits because they haven't come out yet.
They're
like, what have you been doing for the past like 3 years? And it's like, well, one is a show that hasn't come out yet. I don't think I'm even allowed to talk about it. I think I can say that I'm writing on Big City Greens right now, but the stuff I'm writing won't come out for another 2 years or so. So like people are like, I want to check out your things. It's like, you can't. I either can't talk about it or you gotta wait.
I'm writing things that are going to come out of the mouths of animated characters in 3 years' time.
Yes.
It's great. It's a fun job. If you've ever wondered why there's not a lot of topical content on an animated show.
I will say, though, I kind of love that. After writing for the internet for years and, like, sort of needing to be, like, on top of everything and, like, have a take, it's really actually kind of refreshing to write stories that are, like, you kind of just have to write, like, timeless human stories because it's, like, it'll be a while before it comes out. So don't link it in time too much, you know?
I walked into the experience of having watched a lot of Dimension 20, seen you on Dimension 20, seen a lot of these other people on Dimension 20. And like sitting down with people, the majority of whom are professional improv comics and comedy writers.
Yeah.
Very intimidating, you guys. They did this thing that was really, this is not meant, there will be regular Dear Hank and John, but they did this thing that was a very good idea where the day before we started recording, we played a little game together.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we kind of developed some relationships and we played, you know, one session in the world that was not recorded. And I put it on my phone because I'm such a fanboy. I was like, I want to save this. So I recorded it on my phone so I can listen to it just
That's
for me.
Great.
And it was that was the scariest moment, aside probably from like the very first like time I had. It was like my turn to go and develop my story a little bit. But then it like went so well. Everybody's so crazily supportive. And you in particular, like your character, you immediately embody this horrible man. He's not horrible. He's a good guy, but right. He's like not an effective person.
No.
And
no,
okay. I like the character you created was just such a delight. So I'm so excited to have people actually watch it. It's on Dropout TV, which does cost money. I apologize.
Yeah. Sorry for promoting
what
you have to pay for. I'm sorry.
It's got so much good stuff though on it.
But yeah, I think you're right too, that like I think that is why that there is that session zero where, cause like that is the scariest point where it's like, oh, I'm playing for an audience, but I'm also playing for the people at this table. And if you can like get one session to like clear out the anxiety about the people at the table and be like, we're all friends here. Here's one less thing to worry about. Like we'll get comfortable and then we'll worry about entertaining all the people out there.
And I was like, aren't we going to make this like a Patreon exclusive or something? And they were like, literally no. The point is that there's no audience.
Yes.
Just accept it. Which was hard for me.
Because you can monetize this.
You're telling me that I'm not supposed to talk right now? That I'm not currently making content? I don't know what that's like. Me walking through the forest and filming things, being like, I bet I should make a video about lichen. That's my life. So you want to answer some questions from our listeners, Trap?
Let's answer some questions, yeah.
I miss y'all so much. We've filmed for like 5 days and I'm like, my summer camp friends.
That is what it feels like. It's like a series of like brief, intense, and like you go through a big adventure together and then it just all kind of fades away.
Yeah. And somebody cooks the food for you. It's great. It's just like summer camp. All right. This first question comes from Hannah, who asks, Dear Hank and Trap, why is it called Eastern and Pacific time? Why not Eastern and Western or Pacific and Atlantic? Never been to Montana, Hannah. For clarity, and I've said this before on the podcast, Hannah Montana is not from Montana. Her last name is Montana. She is from Texas. I don't know why her last name is Montana. I guess just because it sounds good. It is a constructed identity after all.
It does feel like time zones are sort of named a little willy-nilly, especially when you cram mountain time in there where it's like,
hey,
that's right.
It's where the mountains are.
We're cramming it. Well, I do think like, I don't know the answer to this. I'm going to venture a guess here.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to venture a guess that it is that everything is coming from like an Eastern centric point of view, because that does seem to be how things go, where it's like, well, clearly this is Eastern time. And then for them, everything after that is Western. So like, well, we have to be more specific than Western because the rest of the country, that's all West. And like, they needed to like define it more. That's kind of my guess, but.
I don't know that there was like an oral history of how this happened, but that is definitely part of it. That the West, what we consider to be West, is so big that you can't have a Western time because I am in Montana, which is definitely the West. Like you think of Montana as more Western than you'd think of California being or Oregon. But so it's like, can you say Western? But also importantly, there is an Atlantic time zone.
Ooh.
It is the one that is east of Eastern. So Puerto Rico is in it. The Virgin Islands are in it. That was taken, or I don't know. Somebody had to name these things. So it was, there is an Atlantic and a Pacific time. It's just that those are not referring to the parts of the U.S. that are Atlantic and Pacific.
Interesting.
Though, there's a lot of Pacific out there that also is in different time zones.
Yeah, that's true. Because you get the other end of the Pacific.
Yeah, there's so much Pacific that it seems it's a little bit nuts that America's like, this is Pacific time. It's the part that contains a very narrow slice of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, it's like, what about
the biggest of the oceans?
What about like a lot of Asia and what about parts of Russia and Hawaii and the Polynesian Islands? Like, that's all Pacific too.
Yeah, I mean, the part that's the Pacific time zone should be the one that has the least stuff in it. And I have no idea what that time zone is called. But yeah, I was a little bit surprised to find that there was an Atlantic time zone, even though obviously lots of people live in it.
Yeah, it feels like that, like just thinking about how this sort of like Eastern centric view of like so much West, it's like, I still sort of feel like sometimes when people talk about like the Midwest, it's like, you know, it's like a lot of that's more East than it is West. Yeah. Like you could call it the Midwest, but like, I don't know, like where you, it's all like, it's just pure historical reasons why it's like,
yeah.
Yeah,
it's because the people on the East Coast, as a person in Montana, I accept your lack of interest in what's going on, and that's fine. It's fine. But also, if you ever say to me, "Oh, Montana, I go there sometimes." And because what I'm going to hear is I go skiing or fishing there. Like I go to Whitefish or I go to Big Sky, which is a ski resort. I know what you mean. You don't go to Montana. You like fly in on your private jet and you do a thing and then you leave again.
I remember when I grew up a military brat, so I moved around a lot. And when I moved from California to Maine, I remember talking with a lot of people, and they were like, "Oh, what part of California did you just come from?" And I was like, "Oh, you know, around San Francisco, around the Bay Area." And the number of times people would say something like, "It's like, oh, that's cool. I just visited San Diego last summer," and like I'd have to sort of like explain, it's like the California geography. Like, you have to understand that would be like me being like, "Oh, I'm so glad to be here in Maine. I went to North Carolina." last summer. It's like it's pretty far apart. There's a lot of space.
Yeah, I got confused by San Diego for a while. I don't know it particularly. I was like, I don't know, could be anywhere.
Yeah,
could be really anywhere between LA and San Francisco, and I don't think it even is.
No, it's south of LA.
I've figured that out now. I've gotten there. I actually am going to San Diego shortly. We'll have already gone when this podcast comes out. And I was like, I can take the train from San Diego to Los Angeles. And I did. I booked the train ticket on Amtrak. And they were like, here's your train ticket. It's going to be amazing. It's like, you could go three times on this day. I picked my time. I'm going to be up there. And then they sent me an email and they were like, that train line doesn't exist anymore. But we can get you on a train, take you to a bus stop. You could take a bus to another train station and then take a train to Los Angeles. And I was like, oh, I will drive. Like, that's fine. That's no thanks for that.
I remember
I was so excited about my train trip, and it's just canceled.
It was like supposed to be like one of the most beautiful train trips you can take, because it just like goes along the beach in Southern California. Just look at the waves. I remember hearing about this. I wasn't clear whether it was a permanent closure or whether, because I think it was somehow related to like the like rains washing away some important part of the tracks or something. So I wasn't sure whether it was like, important. Oh, we have to rebuild some things, or whether it was like, no, we're permanently closing this.
But whether they were like, well, the train broke, so it's America and we're not going to fix that.
I mean, there was a period a year or two ago where there was a portion of the Amtrak line in Big Sur that like, there was a big old mudslide and washed it away. And it was the same thing. It's like, we'll take you halfway to San Francisco, then you can get on a bus and go through the mountains, and we'll unload you on the other side. Then keep going. It's like, none of this is efficient or logical at all.
Yeah. We'll figure out trains right around the time when we, like right before we invent transporters from Star Trek.
Right.
And don't need them anymore. I'm glad that we figured out the answer to your question, by which I mean we definitely did not. This next question comes from Leah, who asks, "Dear Hank and also Trap, what would happen if I blended my smoothie for a whole year? I assume the smoothie would be blended so hard that it would just disintegrate into nothingness, but feel free to prove me wrong. Have a blended day, Leah."
Yeah. So we're talking about a single smoothie,
one smoothie
in a blender.
One
and
blender.
You turn it on and you just let it go for the whole year.
One year.
I, so I assume that there is a point at which you hit like terminal smoothness, like a sort of terminal velocity.
Yeah,
like there's a point at which it's like, this is as smooth as this smoothie's going
to
get.
Nothing new to cut. Yeah. Everything that can get cut got cut.
Yeah. But
correct.
But what I kind of started wondering with this was, what happens to, like, does the movement, does the motion keep, like, bacteria from developing on this? That certainly not, right?
Yeah, I think we got a couple of problems.
You're saying I shouldn't drink this smoothie at the end of this?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I do wonder because mold does not all funguses, but mold specifically do require for the fungus to be able to build a structure with all of its stuff sort of tied together and sort of hyphae, like these like root structures that would also be getting blended. So right. Like they wouldn't be able to form a mold. Bacteria don't care. They're like, ooh, fun. Like it's a roller coaster and food. It'd be like a water slide made of smoothie for a bacteria.
Sure.
It's
just
like you're
having
a great
time.
and it's kale and carrots and apple juice. Great.
Uh-huh.
So I think that it would, you know,
honey or something kind of antibacterial in there. Is that going to help at all?
Well, there is a way to put enough something in there that so this is what this is correct. This is the correct course of action. I like
okay,
this.
Okay, great.
We'll put something in the smoothie that makes it so the bacteria don't grow, or we dose it with a bacteria that's like cool,
that'll like outcompete like a lactobacillus or something,
or
like a
yeast, yeah, okay. Like something good that actually maybe makes it into booze, and then you got a booze smoothie at the end of the year, and that's. Surprise! You thought you were going to get the smoothest smoothie of your whole life, but actually you're drunk. And it's like kind of a chill kombucha vibe.
Sure.
I think there's also a reality that your smoother is going to be adding energy to the system the whole time.
Mm.
And I'm worried about the heat that your smoothie might get up to.
Yeah, I was wondering too, but I mean, we should talk about the heat for sure, but also like just the pure mechanical problems of this engine running for, like, I feel like I get nervous running my blender for like 60 seconds. I'm like, this is too long. This is crazy. You know,
it's like, making a lot of noise.
Yeah.
That's loud.
I feel like I'm actively breaking something just by having this running. To have it running for a full year. It's like, I feel like that, We'll talk about the heat first, though.
I think that if we took a blender from the 60s, that thing would just keep going.
Don't make them like they used to.
Exactly. So we have to get an old one, because nowadays I think you're right. I think they'll just shake themselves apart in 25 minutes. But those 60s blenders, they were made by people who were making airplane engines, like the same man. Not the same company, the same man made both the smoothie and the airplane engine. And it's just going to go.
On the same wonderful day where he was like, he accidentally chucked a banana into the jet engine and was like, holy moly, this goop's delicious.
we're really going to change things around here, Jeff. I think the heat in the system, the main, like, I think that you might actually get some. Well, also there's going to be oxygen in there and it's just going to be oxidized, like, you know, like a banana in a room. It's not going to
be real
good.
Brown.
It's even if there's no bacteria around it, it will break down. And so I think that what you're going to end up with is very smooth. And if you dosed it, if you got a good blender that's from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you have like a thing in there to keep the temperature good. You're gonna have some antibacterials. You're gonna have a very smooth smoothie that's gonna taste not good.
But how smooth is it? Does the smoothness make it worth it?
It's gonna be a textural experience.
If it's like a level of smooth, it's like I am transcending to another plane by how
this
smooth
might be,
this is.
This might be how life happened. You know, it's like you take a bunch of non-living chemicals, mix them around, add some heat. Maybe you invent life again.
That would be, I mean, this is like a new like Frankenstein thing where it's like, I just wanted to have a very smooth smoothie and somehow I've become God. Created life and I don't know what to do with my own creation.
Yeah. Okay. It has thoughts now and feelings and it doesn't want to die.
Jamba Juice sells it for $8.
Yeah, but not as a smoothie, more as a friend, just a companion.
And if I get 10 of these, the next one's free? Okay.
You can't keep making these things, Jamba Juice. They have thoughts. They have feelings.
This is an ethical problem.
They're normal men. Just innocent men. Okay, here's another one. It's from Andrew, who says, hello, blank and blank. So it's almost like they knew. Hello, Hank and Trap. I'm a high school teacher, and I get to overhear some of the greatest sentences ever. Recently, I had two students walk into class arguing, and one of them said, you're hallucinating. Potatoes are infinitely more versatile than cheese. Oh, wow. To which a third student across the room yelled, I've been preaching this for years. What is objectively and or subjectively the most versatile food, slightly more versatile than Gouda, Andrew? I have strong and definite opinions on this subject.
I have thoughts on this, too. So my immediate thought was just an answer to the debate that was going on that was overheard, which is that I think cheese is easily more versatile than potatoes.
I think cheese is easily more versatile than potatoes.
I think
potatoes are very versatile. I'm not taking anything away from
chips, I come here fries, not to bake. Besmirch the good name of potatoes.
Absolutely. One of the very best things that ever happened, a potato.
But I do think that, you know, you look at, like, cheese can go on almost anything. It can be a dessert. It can be a whole meal. I think there's no question even here. Like, I don't know how much we even need to get into this because it's, like, so clearly, like, knocking out of the park.
I feel like these children do not understand. They haven't experienced anything like the true versatility of cheese. Yeah. I was going to go shopping for my roommates and in college. Mm-hmm. And someone had written cheese on the list, and I said blank. This was his name.
Yeah,
I don't think that was his name when he was born. But I said blank. What kind of cheese do you want? And he said regular. This is an opinion of a person who that a potato is more versatile than cheese. That's an opinion of a person who thinks there's a regular cheese.
Yeah, there's main cheese, and everything else is a spin-off.
By which he meant Kraft American Singles.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That's regular cheese, which I get. Okay. If there's a regular cheese out there, that's it. at least for an American college student. But oh my God, so much cheese. But Trap.
Yes.
Cheese is a kind of another food.
That was exactly my thought process too.
Because
it was
us.
Like,
look at
potato
us. Like
is a food in of itself, but cheese is a processed food. So if you're going to say that cheese is more versatile, you then also have to say, well, milk is more versatile than cheese because milk includes the subset cheese, but also everything else that milk does. But then I also had the question.
Does it also include all of the milks?
Sure. Wait.
So we're not just saying cow milk, all the milks.
So milk as a general category, milk, anything a mammal creates is
walrus milk, platypus
whale milk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Camel milk.
Polar bears. Uh-huh.
I also was wondering, and I'm curious what you think about this. Is salt a food?
No, actually, I think that this has come up on this podcast.
Oh, no. Because salt's in everything.
Yeah, and you don't turn salt into other stuff. You turn stuff into other stuff with salt. But salt is a rock. Salt is a mineral. That's like that. If that were the case, water would be the most versatile food.
I mean, I'm just going to broach this very question to you.
Yeah. Because, like milk is made of water and stuff. So in that case, cheese is made of water and stuff. Meat is made of water and stuff. But
we just go down to the atomic level. We're finally saying, like, I think carbon's the most versatile food.
Definitely. It can be each of the things. It can be salt. It can be carbs. It can be alcohol. It can be the other one that I forgot.
I also think there's potentially an argument to be made for, I was just thinking of like, well, what do we grow a lot of? What do we eat a lot of? If I was just thinking, like, and there might be an argument to be made for soy being an extremely versatile food.
Yeah, soy and corn. Yeah.
Yeah. Because those, I mean, like, just in terms of pure industrial uses, those go into just about everything. And, like, you can have a meal that is, like, miso glazed soy with some edamame on the side. And it's like, that's just, like, soy three ways. But, you would kind of look at that and be like, yeah, that's a meal.
Yeah. Whereas you can't really have, like, butter on cheese with a glass of milk. Like, that's, nobody's having that dinner.
Not without severe regrets at the end of the night.
I could do it. I could pull this off. I don't know that you can make, like, a bread out of cheese, but you can. Well, you can't really make a soy bread, but I bet you can. I bet somebody has made soy bread.
Yeah.
And they make soy milk.
And you can, like, turn almost anything into a flour, it feels like. You dry it out and grind it up.
Seems
and,
like it these days, yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's not going to be super effective all the time, but it's like, yeah, here's soy flour. You can do something with that.
It's a wild world that we live in now where we've decided to flour everything.
Yeah, everything gets flour. And
also
and
milk everything.
Yeah.
it's shot. And it's like, what milks are next? I mean, I'm totally in favor of getting animals out of the process. It seems like a lot to ask of another organism to be like, hey, I know that that's for your baby, but I'm a 42-year-old man and I want to put it on a cracker. So get on into this machine. So I'm totally in favor of figuring out other solutions to this problem. But I do wonder what we're going to milk next, because I didn't see cashews coming.
Yeah. It feels like we've hit a lot of nuts. Well, plenty more nuts left.
There's a lot of nuts left.
There's a lot of... I want to say, just because also, like, cauliflower's been big in the, like, I'm pretending to be something else game, that maybe
milk.
Cauliflower milk sound that sounds disgusting. Sounds like maybe someone's gonna try it.
Here's how I feel. I think that we've been at cheese and milk products for longer. Like, we've got ice cream and we've got the regular milk, and we've got all the different cheeses, and we've got curds and whey, and I don't know what else we do with. There seems like we're doing a lot, but I think that we've been working at some of these other problems for less time, where we can actually, like, turn, like, I think, in my opinion, fungus is the future. I think that we're going to figure out how to make anything out of fungus. We'll have mushroom milk and mushroom cheese and mushroom meat and mushroom everything.
There's been a lot of dairy substitutes in my house lately, because my daughter has my young infant daughter has an insensitivity to cow milk protein, which means that my wife cannot consume any dairy or eat any beef. Otherwise, my daughter will have health problems when that protein passes through the breast milk. And so we've been just trying, like, it's like, what's this? Is this any good? Is this? And my wife was particularly fond of a fungus-based cream cheese substitute. She was like, this is actually pretty close. It's like, it's weird
as
hell.
Oh, is it Nature's Find?
Yes.
I love that. It's so good.
It's like,
we did sponsors for them on SciShow. We did a whole thing at Complexly to sponsor. And, like, they sent us some of their chicken nuggets.
Right now.
And, yeah, I mean, their cream cheese is better than cream cheese. It's so good. And it's based on the fungus, like, grows in the hydrothermal vents at Yellowstone National Park or something.
I love that. If we can harness fungus to make me any food I want, like, what a dream. What a horrifying dream. A beautiful, horrifying dream. Yeah. Like, people sometimes wrinkle their nose at, like meat grown in vats and things like that. And I'm kind of like, no, let's do that. That sounds incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to figure out what time zones are in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but they don't have names on this map.
Oh.
There's got to be somebody who's... Maybe... Do the time zones not all have names? Sure they do. They must.
I mean, I guess it's... Well, like, who named them? Now I'm wondering. Now I'm, like, going back and thinking about this, because, like... Because you're covering full vertical swaths of, you know, of the world. You're cutting across many countries every time you're like, this is the time zone. Do they have the same name in other countries?
Yeah.
Or did everyone agree, like, yeah, like, this is what this time zone is?
Right, right. Like, or is it like, it's got to be like any other place name where, like, the people in the place call it something and then everybody else calls it their, like, whatever they felt like that day. Like, Florence. Like,
is most of, like, the Firenze. Eastern time zone in, like... Western South America, right? Because that aligns like that, right? I'm not looking at a map, so maybe I'm sounding
The Eastern time zone is Western South America.
So do they call it the Eastern time zone in South America?
That's a great point! What do they call it? If you're from Peru, please let me know what you call your time zone. If you call it Eastern time, that must be so annoying. So mad.
That's some deeply that's annoying some, colonial stuff there. Like, we decide this Eastern United States, everything here is to the east.
Yep. You forget how far to the east South America is, but yeah. It is all over there.
Isn't China all in one time zone too?
Like they did put all of China in one time zone. China was like, here's what we're going to do. I know it sounds wild, but we're going to go over a border and time's going to change by 8 hours. trivia boys here.
Trivia boys.
speaking of which, what do you call a potato wearing glasses while it's watching a football game?
What do you call a potato wearing glasses while it's watching a football
game? It's a spectator.
Aw. I kind of like that.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Kind of.
Okay. Let's do another question here. It's from Mark, who asks, Dear Hank and Trap, I was surfing Google Maps late last night. Go to sleep, Mark. And I came across a town in rural Georgia with nearly completely circular boundary. It's called Homer, Georgia. Zooming out and scrolling around, I began to notice that, in fact, there were dozens of towns in Georgia and South Carolina with circular borders. Most have slight deviations from the circle to include this or that neighborhood or a plot of land, but many retain a puzzling circularity. In my experience, this is not how we create municipal borders in Ontario, Canada. What gives? What are these towns centered on? As former residents of the U.S. Southeast, do you guys have any idea? I don't know. Did you ever live in the Southeast, Trap?
I did not ever live in the Southeast, actually.
Of all the places.
Yeah.
But I bet you can guess. Distinct boundaries and dogwood trees, Mark. What do you have a guess? I have a guess.
I have a guess that If you have a circular border, you have to be not close to other things for those circles to run into them, to other towns, that is.
Yes, correct. Yes.
So I would guess that they're probably centered on either a church or a like crossroads that is like, mm-hmm. These are the two roads that go through where our town, the town founding was here. And that will either probably be like a church or a crossroads or some kind of point of commerce and be like,
yes,
a 12-mile radius around, like, this point.
Where two rivers come together.
Yeah.
And they just said everything within a certain distance from this point and mathematically defined the town.
Yeah.
Which I kind of love. Indianapolis is actually like this, except instead of it being a circle, it's a square. And now it's like added like little bits onto the side, just like, they incorporate new area. But if you look up Indianapolis, I do this because my brother lives there, and I'm like, this is not what I would have imagined things to look like. But yeah, it's just a perfect little square. It's beautiful.
There's a nice simplicity to having like a perfect square or a perfect circle as like your borders. And certainly if you're trying to be like, here are the borders of our town, it seems very simple on paper to be like 12 miles out from this point or whatever it is. And just sort of like, rather than being like, the northern point is this and the sun is this. But it does feel like you're going to run into like rivers, mountains, other municipalities, things that are like traditionally borders of towns, and that like probably you have to make adjustments for that.
I've just zoomed in on the very precise center of Homer, Georgia, because I was like, well, is it the crossroads? Uh-huh. And there is indeed a crossroads. You are correct. It's very clear crossroads. And the as far as I can tell, the exact center of Homer, Georgia is about 300 feet north of the crossroads. So either
so
Google
annoying.
Maps has just messed with me, or the people who created Homer, Georgia were a little confused that day. Like, it's not like they had perfect surveying equipment.
Right.
So they like decided and drew the line, and then they were like, I guess we're stuck with what we got.
I'm guessing that most of these towns, these circular towns, I'm going to guess that a lot of them are maybe on the smaller side. I don't know if that's
Homer
true or not.
Yeah, Homer has 1,300 people.
Okay. I'm willing to bet that Almost all of these towns has like a field trip for third graders to go visit the center of town. And it's there's probably some plaque there in all of these or something just sort of being like, this is it. This, pretty cool, huh?
I want to see if all of them are like this. Carnesville is kind of like that. Oh, he's right. They're all like this. It just became the way to do it. Let's see where the center of Carnesville is. Oh, no, it doesn't like that at all. Never mind. It's not going
to
let
You're
me do it.
You're getting too close to the truth, Hank. You have to go back. This is Google Maps just stops you. It'd be like, you're digging too deep. Stop looking. Stop looking at the center of Carnesville.
I really love the idea that if you figure out that there's like some hidden code, that if you figure out the like how far from the center of each town or something the center of the circle actually is.
This is all like one
to like some like Dan Brown treasure thing.
Yeah.
Where you find the Declaration of Independence at the end of it or something.
Seems like the
bones of George Washington.
What will be like the fourth installment of National Treasure or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
it's like there's a code hidden in small towns in rural Georgia.
Oh yeah. God. Yeah. You just have to like, yeah. You gotta get a whole new outfit so you fit in. You get a pickup truck with a gun rack on it and go around and be like, look, I'm just a guy who likes history.
Yeah.
It's no big deal. And then at the end of it, you're like, golden teeth. I found George Washington's golden teeth. I'm a millionaire.
They say they can bite through anything.
It's the only thing that can stop something bad.
Yeah.
if you put them in your mouth, you become George Washington, 10 feet tall.
We've all heard the legend, right? We've heard that legend. You put in George Washington's teeth, you become George Washington.
Which reminds me that this podcast is brought to you by, weirdly enough, George Washington's teeth. George Washington's teeth, the good ones, though.
This podcast is also brought to you by the smooth smoothie at Jamba Juice. It's so smooth, it's sentient.
This podcast, additionally, is brought to you by the Eastern Time Zone in Western South America. That's some BS.
This time zone also brought to you by a lamp grown out of fungus. You can grow anything out of fungus if you try hard enough. Why not a lamp?
That's where the future is going. This next question comes from Daphne, who asks, Dear Hank and Trap, I recently saw this artistic post with the caption, Get under the shower, you dirty b-. And I was really caught off guard by the use of under rather than in. Should it be under? I understand that we get in the bath because we're literally in the water, but we aren't in the water in a shower. We're under it. When we talk about showers, do we mean the glass box that we stand in or the stream of water coming out of the shower head? Starting to think John might be right about baths, Daphne. First of all, I guess it's fine. You can bathe whatever way you like. Ugh.
I'm sorry.
Are you a bather?
I am not. And the place I live now has no bath. It just has a shower. So even if I was a bather, I would have no choice.
It's
I wouldn't be
option.
Able to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like this question because, you know, my initial response to hearing like get under the shower is like, that's so wrong. Don't say that. That's not the right preposition for that. But then it is like, well, I do think that like a shower by definition has to be above you, right? Like you can't have a shower coming from any other direction.
But I think I can get in a shower and not get wet.
Okay. So you're saying the shower is defined.
Because I think that you're getting in the shower.
Okay.
It's the room. It's the small little room that is created for the water to be.
But you can have showers of things that are not the shower, right? Because you can have rain showers or showers of light. And like that
right.
can still apply
this
to.
Is true.
And those
if
are
I go
all
outside.
Things,
and yeah. it's raining, like it's a shower.
It's a shower.
It's a, and it's that a would... light. I'm having a really hard time with the calling of a rainstorm a shower, which is a thing that we do, but now I don't like it anymore. I'm protesting, and I don't want to.
Named
I don't want
by
to
one
do
particularly
it.
Dirty man who was like, there's a shower outside. It's like that's not what that is. That's rain. We know what rain is. Like no, it's a shower, and it's my
I
lucky
totally
day.
Got... I don't have an umbrella.
Yeah.
I don't need to do that. What are they say like light showers. I hate this now. Why do I not like this suddenly?
Now it feels like it's designed to clean you.
Yeah.
But I do think, but also like if you had a shower stall and there was a shower nozzle that was coming from any direction but above you.
If you got a hotel
and you went to the bathroom,
shoots
and
from
like,
the sides,
and they're like, here's the shower, and it just like blasts from the sides. I feel like I would be like, that's not a shower, that's something else.
By far the best option here is if it comes right up from the bottom.
Right.
Like, it's just the giantest bidet of all time. And it's just like, we know where the problem is.
It's like, yeah, this is where most of the filth. It's like those things bartenders use to clean glasses, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Just sort of put the glass on top and just blasts water up. You're just in a compartment with one of those.
It doesn't turn on until your feet hit it.
And it comes so strong and so hard. You really want it to stop. I hate the shower.
Is it a shower?
I think
it's a shower if it's in the shower. Also, you don't just get in a shower. If I'm telling you that I'm about to be showered and I'm going to clean myself, I don't say I'm going to get in the shower, do I? I say I'm going to take a shower.
Sure.
Which makes me think that just a great deal of empathy for people who have to learn how to speak English. What? You're not taking it anywhere. Where are you taking it?
Well,
it's not yours. You're not like what? What is the shower that is being taken? Is it the concept? Is it the action?
Well, to loop things back around to rain too. I didn't think about this until I took Russian in college. I retained almost none of it, but one of the things I did retain was like really taking in how strange the construction "it's raining" is, because what is raining? It is raining. And it's like, what does it refer to? It's like just the general state of being, like the outside is raining right now. Like, that's not right either. It's just like it is raining, and that construction doesn't exist in Russian. In Russian,
interesting.
If you want to say it's raining, you say like the rain goes. Or something similar to that. It's like the rain is going right now. It's like, well, that feels awkward to me, but it does make a little bit more sense.
Does make more sense than it.
Yeah.
It's like, is it God? Like, what is...
It is raining. Like, oh no. I like this less than there are showers.
Yeah. And I'm going to take one. And then I guess I'll have it, but I won't have it anymore. I will have had it.
Right.
Momentarily.
I took the shower.
I took a shower. And then it stopped existing.
But to go back for a second now,
you said
something about like getting into the shower, like that defines the shower or something. Like, well,
yeah, I can get into the shower and not get wet. I cannot take a shower and stay dry, but I can get into the shower and not be wet.
Okay.
I can be in there just like, I don't know, watching a movie.
I see. So you're saying that is a more precise way of, because if you say get under the shower, that means you are under the water. But if you're saying get into the shower, you can be within the stall of the shower, but not under the shower of water.
Yeah. But I also think that in this particular construction, whereas whatever the joke was that you got to take a shower, you dirty, you can't. In that situation, you got to say get under the shower. It's abstracting from the normal speech so that we can like enjoy the phrase more. Because if you just said take a shower, you dirty, that's not fun. And if you say get in the shower, you dirty, that's a little more fun than take a shower, because it's like you get in there. I'm telling you to get in. But if it's get under, that's more fun. I don't know.
I agree with that.
Language.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when writing advice, like they always say, like, avoid cliches. But so much of this is because you just like, once you hear a phrase enough times, like it no longer makes an impact anymore.
Right.
And I think it's that. It's like, you just like tweak the words enough to be like you really have to think about a shower now that I've like changed the structure of this just a tiny bit.
Yeah. It's like creating some kind of structure that's pointing out the sort of ridiculousness of the phrase "take a shower."
Yeah.
Or "it's raining." Give me something that pulls me out of the sort of tropes of English speech, and I'll be like, well, that actually is more like what I'm doing. I'm more getting under the shower than I am taking one,
or over the shower if you decide to install one of our crazy bartender glasses.
Okay, well, I think I learned way more about both the English language and water being sprayed on people than I expected to today. This next question comes from Sabrina, who asks, Dear Hankentrap, why is surprise such a large source of joy? Like, people go out of their way to buy a surprise. Surprise toys, mystery boxes, and bags. And there are even places on Etsy where they will send you a surprise outfit. Now, I have to admit, I am also a victim to the marketing scheme of a surprise. For some reason, the joy of opening a box with a mystery in it is so much more satisfying than picking something out for myself. Why are we so much more willing to spend money on a mystery rather than a sure thing? A teenager, but not a witch, Sabrina. That's a great question. I hadn't really thought about that, despite the fact that I run a surprise sock company.
Never questioned why people would want to purchase your product.
I don't know. I have always kind of thought that that's kind of a bit of a drawback, that you don't get to know what the socks are going to look like before they arrive. But now I'm thinking, yeah, it's kind of a little surprise that I get to have.
I like it. I'm fully with Sabrina here. But this is coming from someone who I'm a very indecisive person, and I feel like and it only gets harder for things that don't really matter. Like, if it's a choice that really matters, it's like you can do a pretty good weighing of like pros and cons and stuff like that. But if it's something like, let's say here's 80 different patterns of sock you can have, and it's like, I have to make a choice if I'm going to buy a pair of socks, but I don't I don't want to. Doesn't really matter, but I still have to make a choice. And like, that can be kind of paralyzing. So having someone else just be like, I'm going to take care of this for you, I think is very comforting. And then you get, but I don't also don't think, so that's comforting, but there is, I think, a second, there's like a separate joy that comes from like actually like the discovery, right? Of like actually opening it and seeing like, what is this thing? What did I get? And that's, I think, a separate thing from just like avoiding a decision.
Well, I think there's a piece of that's like, can someone curate this for me? Like, I need a person who's better at socks than me, and I'd like you to choose that. I actually have there's a local business in town that will give you a thrifted item. You pay a monthly thing, and they'll just like give you one of the things that they thought was really cool, and I love it. I love it. I wore one of them on our series, everybody complimented me on that shirt. So the fuzzy red one with the collar, that when that one's there, every single person I walked by on that day was like, oh my. Well, I love that one. And so I was like, what's wrong with all my other clothes? No one has said anything for the other five outfits.
Oh, we deeply hate those. Just so you know, we really, really hate those.
So I do love the curation aspect of the person that I trust making a decision for me. But I also think that there is something to, like, I don't know what it's going to be, and then I find out what it is. I love that. I think it's a value that is delivered. And I like a blind bag from like the Disney store with a Mickey that's painted like Boba Fett. Maybe I'm into that. I don't know why. It's the experience.
Yeah, I think
I
there
got
is
neurotransmitters.
What I'm running into is the sort of like I'm like running into like that endless chain of why, right? Or it's because like I do think there is something inherently joyful about discovery, like the chance to experience something new, for the chance for novelty. The chance to, like, that is, I think, inherently joyful. And going, like, getting a box and being like, I don't know what's inside this, but for that moment, it has the potentiality to be something that could be incredible, something you've never seen before that would really make you happy.
Right.
There's maximum potential in there. And I think
there's almost anxiousness as well. Like, there's worry in that moment. The worry is part of the excitement. Like, I don't know what it's going to be. And I'm worried that I'm like, sometimes like, maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm not going to like it.
Yeah. And I think that it is something that is like, that is just like deep within us. Like, I think about surprise a lot because I write comedy scripts, and like so much of comedy is about surprising people, but in a way that like also makes sense and is logical. And so it's like, okay, well, how do you like blend those two together? And like, how do you set up expectations in just the right way so that you can come in from the other side and surprise someone? And I spend so much time like trying to like arrange the conditions for maximum surprise, but not a lot of time asking like, but why do we like to be surprised? Like, why is the surprise in and of itself like something that is a joy. And I don't know, but it does feel like something like deep and biological.
Yeah. I bet it is an evolved trait that conferred advantage to our ancestors, you know?
Sure.
Where it's like, and I think that humor is one of, it's hard to see it in other species. I'm not going to say that it's definitely not there, but it's very there for people. It's a really big deal, and it's so weird. Like, I bet if and when we meet some other intelligent species 1,000 years in the future, they won't have humor like we do. They won't have laughter like we do. They like that. I don't like it. It seems weird enough that it's probably something that wouldn't happen every time an intelligent living system evolved. And like that makes it really special, I feel like. Whereas music is all around, like lots of different organisms make music, which I think is another really lovely thing that people do. But jokes feel pretty just human.
Yeah.
We're so goofy.
maybe a little like something you said made me think about, maybe it was in Sapiens. I don't know if you read that book.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's something I read that was talking about like how much human evolution has been sort of like supportive of risk takers, or from a sort of broad point of view of like humans have been rewarded for taking kind of insane risks,
yeah.
Whether that is like canoeing across the Pacific or spreading across like continents and being like just like a little bit crazy, like just crazy enough to like take these big risky moves that. A lot of times fail, but sometimes pay off, and then they pay off big.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if this is all tied together this sort of like you're being rewarded for taking risks. You're being rewarded for unknown, for like looking at the unknown and going like, ooh, that's cool, right?
Yeah.
And if you're being like sort of if you're getting like this like, you know, dopamine rush from like, wow, the unknown, that's cool. And then to tie it back to your like, do aliens have humor? Like, that does that mean that like we just look totally insane? Like we're just laughing and giggling and taking insane risks and just like a little bit crazy. Like we're like the crazy old prospector that you come into that is, he was just like giggling and laughing. It's like, man, that species is just off its rocker.
Well, I mean, please let me know if you know about this out there listening. Because so there's a lot of there are traits, so evolution does this, where you have a visible trait that's representative of something else, but it's actually a good representation. Like antlers growing out of the head of an elk are going to be bigger if that elk is better at finding resources and fighting off people competing for those elk competing for those resources. So like it's an actual sign of that elk's ability to thrive is how big the antlers are. You know, it's older, it's been able to eat a lot of food, it's big, it's strong. And so it's not like something you can fake. You can't grow big antlers if you didn't actually succeed. And so maybe this is like humor and like the feeling of joy at surprise might be, or like not necessarily being able to make a joke, but being able to enjoy one might be like antlers, but for like risk taking, like safe risk taking and like social success, where if you're good at like enjoying and laughing at a joke, it's a surrogate signal that you are also good at being curious and taking a risk intelligently.
Interesting.
And so that's like humor evolved as a way to signal our ability to do those things. Seems like something that a researcher might have looked into. And if you know about that, please send me the paper because I would love to see that.
I could also see, but now we're just talking about humor instead of surprise. Yeah. Well, they're kind of
tied. They're tied.
Like there being something to this developing as just a way of dealing with the sort of like the cosmic horror of consciousness being like
conscious organism about, is really goofy because you can't do it otherwise.
You can't, it would just drive, it's like, it's that you have to be a little goofy or you have to go totally insane.
Yeah.
You have to like look at the world around you and be like, this is so crazy. None of this makes any sense. To be conscious right now on this earth is so unlikely and so stupid that I have to laugh at it. Otherwise, I will just crumple into a ball at the like, enormousness.
I need someone to do a big fart right now or else. Yeah. Like, it's not going to work. We can't be humans without, like, nice big fart sounds that we can have a good time with. I like that farts are loud. I think I talked about this on Twitter a while back where I said the fact that farts are loud kind of indicates that loud farts didn't hinder our ancestors' ability to procreate, and I love that for them.
It's interesting to, like, something let me posit this question to you.
Okay.
And then I'll back up and explain where this is coming from. Do you think humans have the loudest farts? And now I'm going to back up and say, because humans, I know, have a pretty large butt to the rest of your body ratio, because we are bipedal, and we, like, need those strong gluteal muscles to, like, move us around.
Yeah, they do different kind of work.
A lot of the sound is going to come from air moving between those big old cheeks.
It actually maybe doesn't.
Okay.
So I've looked into how fart noise happens, and it mostly does not. So, like, the cheeks matter.
Oh, of course the cheeks matter.
The actual sound, though,
Tank, of course,
isn't it's not the cheeks hitting each other. The sound is actually the anus itself flapping. So it's the anus smacking together as pressure builds behind, and then the pressure is released. And then when the pressure releases, the anus slaps together again. The pressure builds. The anus opens. It slaps together after it releases. The pressure builds again over and over and over again. It's just like you can do it with a balloon. It's the same, like, mechanistically, the same thing is happening. But
But most of the sound is from the anus and not the
cheeks. Yeah, the cheeks can control what the anus is doing. So, like, if you, like, lift the cheek, you can fart more quietly because the cheek isn't causing the anus to, like, it's not putting that pressure to slap it back together again, but the noise is actually, and also I think that it matters, like, the loudness of the fart matters that the rectum is full of gas, and so, like, is kind of a sound, like, resonant chamber.
I can tell you're a professional radio man, because as soon as you, when you start describing the cheeks clapping together, you clapped too, so the audience could be fully transported to the visual of two cheeks, a fart so loud.
They're not the cheeks, it's the anus. Stop misinforming people. Actually,
Sabrina, did this answer your question about why you like your mystery dress?
but seriously, another thing I really desperately want to know is what species has the loudest fart. And if it is humans, I think that without a doubt, that means that farts, we evolved intentionally loud farts. Like, it's not like it didn't hinder us. It helped us.
I really think there's a good chance that it could be humans. Because I think we do have loud farts. Loud farts. And I think there's probably, like, so many... I try to imagine so many, like, predator-prey relationships where it's like, hey, it is really evolutionarily disadvantageous for you to have a loud fart right now. Like, that jaguar is going to eat you if you let out that, if you, like, let one rip right now. Which is, like, true for humans, too, like, with things prey on humans. But I wonder if sort of, like, I don't know, being sort of top of the food chain for a while or whatever has sort of allowed loud farts to exist.
So then you would think that the things with the loudest farts are going to be either the top of the food chain or the really big animals that don't have to worry so much.
Yes.
I was just reading that hippos, because I was like maybe hippos have loud farts. They don't, though. They have quiet farts. They have long farts and they have disgusting farts, but they don't...
They're silent but deadly.
But they're not loud. So, like, great white sharks can't possibly have a loud fart. They're sharks. Do they fart at all? I don't know. I'd love to know the answer to that question. That seems like something I should know. Elephants.
You didn't catch that scene in Jaws? it's like you've got a great white, the loudest farters on the planet.
I do like the idea that
they're there on the SS Indianapolis.
There's like a mouse hiding from a fox, and it's just like, be very quiet, and its little heart's just, and it's sitting there next to its, like, you know, like mouse wife, and she's like, quiet, Henry, quiet, and then he's like, oh no, Susan, and she's like, what's wrong, Henry, and he's like the tiny mouse fart,
and then
the fox
gone.
Is just like, honk. But we don't have to worry. We're humans. We can fart in front of a great white shark and Actually, probably that would be a bad idea.
We are on a species level, the rude, the like rude husband from a 90s sitcom who's like, we're just letting it go. Like, what are you going to do, eat us? You can't.
Good luck with your time zone, South America. I have so many questions, and I feel like we're about to get to a really deep and true truth about humans. So we need to stop the podcast, because if we get to it through farts, then we're gonna I don't know what anybody's gonna take us seriously, and also it might be a problem for the eventual white paper that we publish in Nature. So, but I'm looking forward to doing that. Everybody, go check out Mentopolis on Dropout TV. It was one of the best things I have ever done in my life creatively. It was so good. So, I'm extraordinarily privileged to have been able to be a part of that cast. So, thanks for doing it with me, Trap, and thanks for coming on.
Oh, I felt privileged to be able to play with you, of course.
It was a great time. And there's also lots of other really amazing stuff on Dropout.tv. If you haven't heard of that or seen it, what's happening? Come on, Game Changer? Come on. It should get Emmys. It's the best. It's like, I hope it gets a Tony, for Christ's sake. I don't know how, but I feel like
how
it
did
could.
They do this? someone put an iPhone on stage and they just let it play autoplay for through a couple seasons of Game Changer, and somehow they got a Tony.
That's how it works these days. If you want to send us questions for the podcast, you can do that at hankandjohn@gmail.com. We don't have a podcast without you, so thank you to everybody who does that. This podcast is edited by Joseph Tunamedish. It's produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas. Our communications coordinator is Brooke Shotwell. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown, don't forget to be awesome.